Thank you. You can be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas Municipal League Intergovernmental Risk Pool versus the Workers' Compensation Fund and subsequent injury fund.
May it please the court, Mr. David Bickham will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. As this court is aware, the issue in this case is whether my client, the TML Intergovernmental Risk Pool, can constitutionally be required to make payments into the subsequent injury fund. And there are a variety of different statutes in the labor code as well as the underlying administrative code rules, the TWCC rules, that we have challenged that deal with how these payments get made into the subsequent injury fund. And the challenge is an as-applied challenge.
Your employees of your respective cities would still be able to claim once the second injury fund and the subsequent injury fund.
As the statute is currently written, that is correct. They would have the ability.
And that's your position, that they should still be able to.
At least until the legislature changes the law, if it so desires. And, you know, obviously the legislature has the ability to make choices to cover employees, you know, with payments from a particular fund, even if it doesn't require payments in. What happened in this case is the legislature attempted to require, or at least on its face, arguably attempted to require cities and other political subdivisions to make payments into this fund. But because the fund is in the nature of an insurance fund, and that the payments into the fund aren't based on the claims made from the fund, under a long line of authority from this court, a lot of various attorney general opinions, the system set up is unconstitutional. And we are attacking the requirement that cities must make payments into the fund to the extent that that's how it's being interpreted by TWCC.
The cases that you rely upon in the attorney general opinions would require us to really look at this as being an accessible insurance program, because that was the basis for City of Tyler as well as some of the discussion in some of the attorney general opinions, correct?
It's correct to the extent that this is analogous to accessible insurance.
But the cases you rely upon, that was accessible insurance.
Those were accessible insurance cases, and
so
those were really the most analogous.
Okay, but you're calling. Are you claiming that this is an accessible insurance program, or are you just asking us to analogize to it? Because an accessible insurance plan really contemplates the payment of premiums, and we don't have any premiums being paid here.
We actually have
unclaimed benefits being paid in.
Well, see, I disagree that it's actually unclaimed benefits. I think what is being paid in, and this court has noted that in the Industrial Accident Board versus Texas Employers Insurance Association case, it's not in the nature of benefits that are being paid in or compensation. Instead, it is an arbitrary amount fixed by the legislature.
But
and they fix that arbitrary amount as the amount that would otherwise have been due had there been somebody under the statute entitled to recover.
Right. It's not a premium, though. It's not an insurance premium that's being paid.
Well, not in the sense that it is a premium in the sense that those funds are then used to pay
claims.
As
we classically think of a premium being paid, I'm going to pay a set amount of money, and in return I'm going to get an amount of coverage, and if I have a claim, then that within the coverage, then in fact the claim will be paid. It's not a premium in that sense of the word.
No, it is not a premium in that sense. And in reality, in an accessible program, what's paid in the form of an assessment is not really a premium either, because it's not based upon your claims history from the fund. It's based upon the fund's current solvency or insolvency, and they can just make a call for money to be paid in, you know, upon the occurrence of some event. And really, although we've used the cases
given that
as an
analogy, let's go back to the original question. Are you claiming that this is an accessible plan?
I am not claiming that it is an accessible plan. I'm claiming that it operates very much like one, and I think the court can view the prohibitions. And the crux of the prohibition is to prevent cities, or to prevent the legislature from requiring cities to take their locally generated revenues and transfer those locally generated revenues in a way where those revenues no longer benefit directly the residents of the particular city or political subdivision, and instead benefit some larger group.
But those benefits could potentially benefit the citizens of the city.
They could potentially. And one of the issues that has not been briefed because of the new nature of the law is, as of May at the earliest and September at the latest, there have been amendments to the provision of the subsequent injury fund in the labor code that talk about how the money can be spent. And that money now is not only used to pay benefits and also to reimburse insurance carriers under certain situations. In section 403.006B of the labor code, it now can also be used in different situations to reimburse insurance carriers at the discretion of TWCC. And the money is also going to be used to fund feasibility studies and later the development of certain regional workers' compensation healthcare networks that are going to be basically HMO-type operation for workers' comp claimants, you know, providing benefits to workers' comp claimants. And I think that those provisions show that the system that is set up is really a system that is taking these monies that belong to the city. It is the city's money when there is no legal beneficiary.
Under what theory is the city's money?
It is the city's money in the sense that the workers' comp statute, these are cities that self-insure. Mm-hmm. Under the workers' comp statute, the money when someone dies of a compensable injury has to be paid to a legal beneficiary.
Right.
And in the circumstances where no legal beneficiary exists, there is a long line of cases that demonstrate that if you have a failure of a condition in the policy, either the lack of a beneficiary or the failure of some event necessary to recover, that the carrier itself retains ownership of the money. Well, what the legislature has done in creating the subsequent injury fund is to transfer ownership from the carrier to the subsequent injury fund.
I'm interested in the ownership issue with the carrier. Is that by statute? Is that by contract that the carrier owns the fund?
It is by common law that in the situations where there is no rightful claimant under the policy, that the carrier retains ownership to the funds. And this court addressed it in the Industrial Accident Board cases. We've given several other cases that have addressed that. The way that the Workers' Comp Commission has attempted to get around that is now by creating a presumption in the statute that if nobody files a claim within a certain period of time, it used to be 8 months, now it's 12 months, that they'll presume for purposes of making payments into the subsequent injury fund only that there is no legal beneficiary. But they're not presuming it for all purposes. So arguably they're saying we're not going to presume it for purposes of ownership. But the reality is the city owns the money until the very moment that either one of two things happens. Somebody makes a valid claim and is entitled to recover, or until they transfer title to the subsequent injury fund.
Well, it seems to me that's how the city assesses how much it needs to set aside for potential injury claims. There will be a certain amount that have to be paid out, a certain amount that don't have to be paid out, and so you spread that out over all the risk that you have of the employees being injured. How does the assessment in this second injury fund, does the city have to pay a premium to the second injury fund to get its workers covered by the second injury fund?
Not as the statute is currently written.
That's separately funded by the state.
Right. It's very analogous.
So the only contribution the city is required to pay in to the second injury fund is if there's any unclaimed funds from a compensation claim or a death, I guess. Those death funds, that's the only payment that the city pays into the second injury fund is just whatever's left over from a death claim when there's no heir to be receiving money.
That is right, except for the idea that these funds are somehow unclaimed. And that was really the crux of the Court of Appeals decision.
I'm assuming they're unclaimed, and I agree with you that it's the city's money. I'm saying that the only money the city is required to pay the second injury fund is that money.
That's correct.
So there's no premium they pay to get their employees covered by the second injury fund.
That's right.
The only requirement they have to pay is this. Now, if the court determines that they don't have to pay that in, that they don't have to pay that in, then the city pays nothing for the benefit of having access to the second injury fund, which benefits its citizens.
For the very short term, I think that would be correct. I think that the legislature could. The big problem with it is the fact that these payments of unclaimed, as you said, death benefits into the fund aren't related to the amount of money that a particular city's employees draw out of the fund. That's been the problem with assessable insurance, and the reason that assessable insurance has been found to be an unconstitutional grant of public money or lending of credit. The legislature could fix it.
How could a city ever buy insurance to cover its employees or its officers if we interpreted to pay in has to be reasonably related to what gets paid out as narrowly as you require? How could they ever buy insurance for that?
Because there have been constitutional amendments. At the time the City of Tyler case came out, the court held that cities couldn't provide insurance for their employees. Then Article 3, in the context of workers' compensation insurance, Article 3, Section 61 was passed that allowed the legislature to pass suitable laws to require cities to provide workers' compensation insurance and to allow for the payment of costs, charges, and premiums on policies and benefits under policies. And then, so that's how it was handled with workers' comp. With regard to other insurance, in Article 3, Section 52A itself, an amendment was passed in the mid-80s that now allows cities and other political subdivisions to purchase non-assessable insurance on a premium basis, but it took a constitutional amendment for cities to be able to do that.
I have a more basic problem, which is how come the Second Injury Fund is an individual association or corporation within the prohibition of Section 52A?
The Subsequent Injury Fund is a bank account, as Mr. Pittner says, but it is administered by the Workers' Compensation Commission, who is also a defendant, which is an organization or association.
It's the state. I mean, what would lead you, given the evil they were trying to prevent, what leads you to say that individual association or corporation includes an entity of the state, which, after all, created this municipality and can abolish it?
Well, if you look at the various attorney general's opinions that have been cited, several of those, one of them was trying to create a state-operated, statewide insurance-assessable network, if you will, for workers' comp claimants. The money that was being paid in the form of assessments was going to be administered by this entity. There have been state guarantee associations that were going to be under the auspices of the state government that were attempted to be created.
Attorney General opinions, but let's reason from first principles.
And the reality is, cities, and it gets to the problems that were discussed in Edgewood and in City of Love versus Dallas, which is more where instead of a private entity, it's the state taking control of locally generated revenues. And in the City
That's
of Love versus...
That's another constitutional amendment and another point of error. Or we don't have this anymore. Another issue in your brief.
Yes, it is.
Why would you argue, based on the intent of the framers and the plain language of this provision, that the Subsequent Injury Fund is an individual association or corporation? I mean, why should we say that?
Because
being bound by
association... At the particularly, you know, when you're looking at in the context of Constitution where you don't have defined terms, you look at it in the broad sense, and the Subsequent Injury Fund is a bank account for an association. That association initially being the Industrial Accident Board, now being the TWCC, and it does comport with the intent of the framers. You know, for example, if you said,
why is it for the benefit of the commission? Why isn't that fund a benefit for the people, entities that contribute to it in order to pay benefits to employees or their beneficiaries statewide?
It is a benefit on a statewide basis. But what these Article 3, Section 52 cases talk about is that the benefit has to be for the benefit of the local public served. Well, there's no doubt that in these other cases...
Excuse me, sir. You said at the very outset in answer to Justice O'Neill that it's the city's money that covers your premise. This is the city's money, which is why it can't be paid to anything that goes outside the confines of that city. But the pool itself is a separate independent entity, isn't it?
The pool is a separate entity that makes cities pay their proportionate shares based upon their direct claims history.
And what you pay to the pool is based on your claims history and all of that.
Right. And right? In fact,
Let me ask you another question. Have you made a complaint that some of the money that your city, if you were from Lubbock, goes to the risk pool, may be paid out to a claimant who lives in McAllen? And so wouldn't that violate this scheme under your viewpoint?
It would, and in the...
So why aren't we complaining about the actual benefits that people get that where your money goes to some other city?
Because
the same theory.
Because the original way that the pool was going to be set up, it was going to be set up where it took the money in from the cities based upon statewide claims. And the Attorney General struck that down and made them rework the way that the organization worked to make sure that it took money in from the cities that was directly based upon that particular city's claims history with the fund. And
that
the proportionality...
That, if I understand that argument, is based on how the amount that a particular city contributed was computed, not on the other end on where it goes. That was
they're part of the same equation.
You just say, we're going to assess you $100,000 a year, all 1,600 of you, and then we got this fund to pay benefits. So you say, well, that's not right because it's not based on what's already been held to be the criteria, our claims history. So they change it based on the claims history. So you are a small city, you pay $15,000. Lubbock pays $100,000. But the money goes to the fund and it's distributed statewide. Why isn't that unconstitutional?
It is not unconstitutional because of the relationship, because there is a more direct quid pro quo that the city really is paying in. It's paid in based upon its claims history. And so the attempt is to make sure that those local dollars really are benefiting the local individuals of the city. And the legislature, I think, could rewrite the statute in a way that would make the payments into the subsequent injury fund more directly related to a city's particular claims from, or a city's employees' particular claims from the fund, which would probably have the benefit, if it's done the right way, of making it constitutional. The way it's written now, where it's an arbitrary amount based not at all on claims coming in, is a problem. The other problem that is with it is now that it's been amended so that the money's going to be used for so many different things.
And you characterize it as an arbitrary amount because the legislature picked 364 weeks of benefits.
That's correct. It's just a choice that was made.
Difference.
And actually,
But is it true in every case where it's a death benefit that every employer, if there's a designated beneficiary, it has to pay 364 weeks.
That is the fact. And the reality is the legislature has the power to do that for private companies as a cost of their choosing to write workers' comp in the state of Texas. But the constitutional prohibition says the legislature has no power to take the city's monies and do the same thing. And that's really where the issue falls out. It's a matter of, does the legislature have authorization, no matter how good the cause is, do they have the specific grant of authority that allows them to take this money?
Let me get one follow-up question to Justice O'Neill's earlier question that I'm still puzzled by. You keep saying it's the city's money, but at the point in time that the money is paid over from the pool to the subsequent injury fund, at that point in time, there has been a death, and an effort to locate a statutory beneficiary, and none has been located, and the money is turned over, right? I mean,
correct.
That's how the payment is made. why is that still the city's money at that point in time when, in fact, an event has occurred that triggers an obligation for the money to be paid out and no longer kept by the city?
Because the trigger hasn't happened. There are the two parts to the trigger. One is the event occurs, the compensability of the death. The second condition is that somebody, a legal beneficiary, is entitled to take it. And under the constitutional authorization that allows cities to provide workers' comp insurance, the legislature can only, the only payments that the legislature is authorized to allow cities to make are payments of benefits. And this court has already recognized correctly that these payments into the subsequent injury fund are not payments of benefits.
Could the state designated who the legal beneficiaries are? Could the state designate the second injury fund as a legal beneficiary in the event you go, you don't have a spouse, you don't have a children, you don't have parents? If you go through that level, then the fourth level of beneficiary will be the second injury fund.
They did not. Instead, what they say is when there is no legal beneficiary.
Could they?
I think that they couldn't based upon the constitutional authorization to pay benefits, because when the statutes were put in the late 50s and early 60s, I think that the clear intent of the framers, when you're thinking of insurance benefits, are benefits paid to individuals who have an insurable interest in the life of the individual who died. And I don't think that the word benefit should be construed in the context that if the government chooses to say, and if no one else, then we'll take it and put it in our bank account, would really, I think that would violate the specific authorization that allows payment of benefits.
Doesn't it go to the estate?
It does not under the workers' comp code. There is a narrow definition of who a beneficiary is. In the context of traditional life insurance,
right,
it does go to the state, I mean the estate, and it you can actually go down and find heirs, which is why.
And is that why escheat doesn't fit? Because here it never goes, as opposed to it lapses somehow.
That's correct. Here it lapsed, and prior to the creation of the subsequent injury fund, and prior to the time that the rules were written saying insurance company pay the money into the fund, in those cases, the earlier cases that we've cited in our brief, whenever there was no legal beneficiary, the courts held insurance company, it's your money. You get to keep the money because there wasn't somebody making the claim. And so what this statute has the effect of doing is changing the state of the law for the cities from it's your money to pay it over here and we're going to redistribute it in this way we've set up, and that's why it's unconstitutional.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Please, the court. Mr. Joseph Pittner will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. To support its argument that the challenge provisions violate the lending of credit provision, the TML has characterized the subsequent injury fund as an assessable insurance program. And this comparison is flawed, and there are several reasons why that's true. First, it issues no policies, and it has no contractual relationship with the employer or the employees or any other insurance carrier. It has no actuaries to determine risk history or premium rates. It charges no premiums.
But isn't that beside the point?
Ma'am?
Even if it's not an accessible life insurance company, insurance company, it's still not, it still doesn't fit within the exception to 52A, does it?
Fits within the exception?
52A does not specifically allow, it doesn't, the subsequent injury fund still doesn't fit to the express exception to 52A.
That is correct. That is correct, because it's not a corporation, association, or other entity that's covered.
But in the response to that the fund is just used to funnel money to individuals, and that's the constitutional problem. That's not, the money doesn't go to the fund. The fund is just used as a mechanism to funnel the city's money to individuals.
Yes. This is the TML's indirect ad valorem tax argument.
Not a tax argument. I thought they were making the argument that under 52A, What the fund is actually doing is taking the money from the city and turning it over to individuals in violation of 52A's prohibition about lending credit or granting public money to individuals.
In response to that, there is a public purpose exception to the grant of public money. There is adequate public control over the disbursement of this money. It is done by either the commission or the courts in following the statutory standards.
Where's the constitutional exception or authority for, as you call it, public monies?
It is the constitutional exception to the expenditure of public money is that it be expended for a public purpose and not for a private purpose.
And you're saying that giving the subsequent injury fund, when it makes payments to individuals, that's for a public purpose and not for a private purpose?
Yes, ma'am. That is a public purpose.
Is that in the Constitution, or are you just saying that's the case law, the public purpose exception you refer to in your brief?
Yes, sir. That is that is case law. It is not specifically spelled out in the Constitution. Except for, there is Article 3, Section 51, which is the framers' grant to the legislature to require cities to carry workers' compensation coverage for their employees.
The public good argument troubles me. It doesn't seem to be much of a limit to it. Suppose the legislature just imposed a fee on cities to pay state employees or to pay judges. That would be a good fund, pay into a fund for judicial retirement. Why? That would certainly be for the public good because the public's going to have to pay for it anyway. Why wouldn't the Constitution prohibit that?
Well, I believe this is similar to the argument that was decided by the Third Court of Appeals in the Graves versus Morales case, the attorney occupation tax, where it was held that payment of the attorney occupation tax was for a public purpose, attorney occupation tax being for state-employed attorneys.
Yeah, but it's not a payment by a city.
It's not payment by the city. That's absolutely right.
So the state could just, as long as it was for the public good, the state could impose any fees on the cities to help pay the expenses.
I believe the constitutional prohibitions for the state imposing fees is broken down into ad valorem taxes, which the state cannot do, income taxes, which the state cannot do, and occupation taxes. And I believe the other taxes or fees the state might impose are constitutionally permissible if they're imposed on cities. And the basis of our argument is that this required payment of money. We don't believe it is a tax, but if it is a tax, it's not an ad valorem tax.
You so. Agree that whatever is paid in by a city bears no relation to what claims there may be on behalf of its employees.
That is absolutely right. I agree with that. And it is an amount that is set by the legislature at 364 weeks. Of benefits. It has it's not assessed in an ad valorem way. As a matter of fact, it's impossible to assess it as an ad valorem tax because if you have beneficiaries that might be entitled to the money but have not yet come forward, you don't know the ages of those beneficiaries or how long that money would be paid out to them. So,
do you agree with Mr. Beckham's position that this is the city's money?
Well, the cases that were cited in the TML's brief, they began with two very old cases, two Lodge cases, one in 1896 and the other in 1907. In those particular cases, it appears that there was no escheat statute in the state of Texas that escheated life insurance policies to the state. And these two cases were decided on what the bylaws of those two associations stated. In one case, the bylaws stated...
I don't mean to interrupt, but my understanding was that Mr. Pickham was relying on a statute, not cases, that the Texas workers' comp statutes say that the money belongs to the city if a beneficiary can't be found. Do you agree with that?
No, ma'am, I don't. I don't agree with that.
So there is no such statute? That's not the way the system, the framework is set up?
No, ma'am. The way it's set up is that if there is a compensable death, that triggers payment. And if there are eligible beneficiaries,
it goes... Do you know what statute he's relying on? I didn't get a section or anything, but I wrote down that he said under the workers' comp statute, the money is not due if a beneficiary can't be found and therefore belongs to the city.
No, ma'am. I'm not aware there are any such statutory provision.
Is it your position then that once the triggering event occurs, a death, and in fact the money is no longer the city's and is actually once it becomes payable to a statutory beneficiary, whether or not there is a statutory beneficiary to claim the money?
That's what triggers is the compensable death. That's right. And it's either payable.
As opposed to two events, which is the death plus a claim made by a statutory beneficiary.
That's right.
I didn't see a lot in your brief defending the Court of Appeals' escheat argument. Is that, do you have anything to say about it? Or?
Well, I think that the escheat argument is a good one. It is a good analogy. It is not a perfect analogy by any means. And the Court of Appeals used the custodial escheat analogy so that there would not be a passing of title to the state. And if there was not a passing of title to the state, then the Court of Appeals reasoned that there were no constitutional implications. And this was part of the complaint by the TML that the Court of Appeals actually sidestepped these constitutional issues that it had raised. I don't think that the custodial escheat analogy has to be perfect because I think that all the court has to do is to say it operates more like an escheat than it does a tax. So I don't think that you have to go completely through a custodial escheat analysis in order to avoid the challenge that it's an ad valorem tax or it violates the gift of public money or lending credit.
Most escheat statutes require the state to hold the money and then pay it over to some unknown beneficiary. And here, doesn't the state take control and domination and then pay it out to, not to the beneficiaries, but to someone else? It's not a close analogy in that respect, isn't that right?
Well, a custodial escheat, as the Court of Appeals used, the money is held for the appearance of a possible beneficiary, but in the meantime, the state can make use of that money.
Well, the state could deplete the money altogether to people who are not beneficiaries. Isn't that right here? If there were enough claims for it.
Theoretically, that's possible, except for the fact that the new legislation that council mentioned, this House Bill 2600, provides for a funding mechanism if the second injury fund does go bankrupt. And that is an assessment.
Does that legislation govern this dispute here, the new legislation you're talking about? Do we apply it in this case?
I don't think so. I don't think it's really relevant to the issues in this case.
Well, it's different. This isn't really an escheat anyway, because under the workers' comp statute, there's a hierarchy of beneficiaries. And so if none of those beneficiaries exist, they never come into possession of the money. The money stays with the cities unless until there's a beneficiary as designated under the statute, isn't that right? So the money's never paid out to a beneficiary because none of those beneficiaries exist.
Well, but there's a section, isn't there, 403.007D, Doesn't that say if one does come to existence, then the money is paid out?
That is correct.
Yeah, but assuming that, I'm talking about assuming there is no beneficiary, on the question of is it the city's money or not, on the front end, the city's not required to pay anyone unless there is a beneficiary. It's not as if this goes into an estate, the decedent's estate, or it's distributed by descent and distribution or by will, anything like that. There's a designation within the statute of an order of beneficiaries, and once you get to the bottom and there aren't any of those, but for the subsequent injury fund, the cities would keep this money. Is that correct?
No, ma'am. They wouldn't keep the money. They wouldn't keep the money because they are a governmental entity that's defined by the terms of the statute to be an insurance carrier. And insurance carriers are not allowed to keep the money if the beneficiary does not appear. They have to pay it over into
No, but for the subsequent injury fund, if under the comp statutes, if there were no beneficiaries that qualified under the, it goes through the spouse, children, grandparents, siblings, there's a hierarchy there. Assuming there are no beneficiaries, and if you had no requirement that this pool pay the money to the subsequent injury fund, the fund would keep the money.
If the statute was rewritten in that fashion, yes, ma'am.
My point is, there's no requirement to pay anyone. There's no beneficiary that ever takes possession of the money under the statute unless there's a qualifying beneficiary.
There is no beneficiary to take possession of the money unless there is a qualifying beneficiary.
So, but for the requirement that's paid into the fund, it would still be the pool's money.
I disagree.
You would say that would the pool have to pay it to the estate?
No.
And then if there was no beneficiary, it would escheat back to the pool?
Are we talking about the fund or the intergovernmental risk pool?
I'm talking about the risk pool. I'm talking about the let's say that the death benefits are due, right? But there's no beneficiary.
Right.
What happens without the statute relating to the subsequent injury pool? But the risk fund, I mean the risk pool, if they have to pay the benefits upon the death and there were no subsequent injury fund, would they go to an estate? And then if there was no one to claim them, they would escheat somewhere?
The Workers' Compensation Act is not set up to where if there are no eligible beneficiaries that then the money escheats to the estate of the deceased. So it would not.
So it would be the city's money?
It wouldn't be the city's money. The Intergovernmental Risk Pool is just an administrating body for these self-insuring cities. It holds their money in order to pay their claims. It has no direct ownership of that money as such.
What would happen to it? What would happen to it absent the subsequent injury fund? You have a compensable death. Where do those benefits go?
It would remain with the carriers, including the self-insured cities, if there was no subsequent injury fund.
Right, so the escheat analogy just does not apply, and Mr. Bickham was correct then in saying under the statutory scheme that the money would belong to the city but for the subsequent injury fund.
Well, the... Absolutely right, Your Honor. There would be no escheat analogy if there was no subsequent injury fund. The death benefits were not considered life insurance, so they would not come under the life insurance escheat statutes.
Under the workers' compensation scheme, does the state determine who the beneficiaries are?
Yes, Your Honor, they do.
Is there anything that prohibits the state from declaring itself to be a beneficiary under the workers' compensation scheme?
I see no impediment to that occurring. Because, in the same fashion, I think the same policy reasons that apply to unclaimed life insurance policies, where the insurance company is not allowed to keep those proceeds that they escheat to the state, they're held by the comptroller. They're there until a claim is made. If a claim is made in the future, then that money is paid to that claimant. In a custodial estate, the state does not take title to the money. There are provisions in the general estate statutes where when the state takes custody of money or property, then it can file a lawsuit in order to transfer the title to the state. But that's not the case here. It doesn't occur.
But the estate statutes really were when the person who owned the funds no longer exists and there's nobody to whom to give the funds, and so we're determining who the new owner is. This is not the same thing as someone who... This is not like an insurance case where you pay me a premium and I take on the risk of the injury that's borne by a number of people, and there's no claim for this particular risk that comes to fruition. The insurance company, makes logical sense, would keep those funds, if there's no place to pay them, to assist in reducing the premiums to all the people that are paying the premiums, it seems. Estate only works, doesn't it, if there's no beneficiary to accept the funds?
That is absolutely right. If no known beneficiaries are there, then estate works.
But that's because there was a beneficiary who now owns the funds because of the risk, but they're not there to accept them, and so we don't have an owner of the funds to go someplace else.
Yes, Your Honor. That's how estate works. There are certain policy considerations here, too. If this court upholds the trial court's ruling that these two constitutional provisions have been violated, by this statutory scheme, then no self-insuring governmental body will have to pay money into the fund. No county, school districts, the state.
What percentage of the fund do those entities represent?
Ma'am?
What percentage of the overall fund does the risk pool represent?
Of payments into the subsequent injury fund? Probably an insignificant amount.
So
I would
the sky
imagine.
Sky would not fall.
No.
Well, the other hand, would if they don't pay anything into it, would they be entitled to make claims on it?
Well, that's the thing. They would be entitled to make claims. They have never said in any of their pleadings before the trial court or anywhere else that they should be prevented from making reimbursement claims on the fund. They have never said, as a matter of fact, they have said.
I'm a little confused. The subsequent injury fund, as I understood it, exists to make up the difference with the person who already has one injury suffers a second one. So if the employer only pays for the second injury and the fund makes up the difference, is that correct?
That is correct. That difference of lifetime benefits.
So that by paying into the fund, each city could get a benefit whenever they have that situation, because money comes back to them to satisfy that kind of a claim from the subsequent injury fund. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So if they don't pay into the fund, they, under their theory, they don't pay, but they can still make demands and get payments from the fund.
That is correct, Your Honor. They can still take money out even though they pay nothing into the kitty.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So what I just asked you, is that true?
It is true, Your Honor.
Is there something unfair about that?
I don't think so, because I think it's something
Well, but you say, I don't have to pay, but I can take out.
I think it's something the legislature can fix very easily. You know, as an initial matter, the legislature is free to treat its political subdivisions and governmental units differently.
Would you define for me what you think the public benefit exception is or isn't?
The public benefit exception clearly exists with regard to Article 3, Section 52, cases. And as Justice Hecht was noting, you've got to be careful not to read the public benefit exception to be too broad.
Tell me how you read it then.
How you read it and how it's appropriately read and the cases made clear. We've cited the Byrd versus City of Dallas case, the Key versus Marion County Commissioners Court, and how you read it is you look at the particular public to be benefited. And if that is geographically the same as the members of the political subdivision that is represented by the entity that's making the payment, then the public benefit going to those individuals can overcome certain Article 3.
What's the geographic area of the sphere that we're talking about?
Each particular city and political subdivision, and the reason
to
that
make
we...
make up the state.
Right. It's the individual
city. Well, I still just can't understand if 1,600 cities are paying money into the pool, whose function is to take that money and then pay claims out all over the state by the same rationale, and you don't complain about that, that's okay, right? By the same rationale, doesn't apply to the subsequent injury fund, where they're all paying amounts in there and it goes out the same way all over the state.
Because the difference is, and it's a valid question, but a very distinct difference. The difference is these are cities that each individually self-insure. They cover their own particular risk.
Well, I understand
they
it, but they
their
have
resources individually. But the payments they make are based upon the proportionately the amount of claims that their citizens make, and that's not the case with the subsequent injury fund. The subsequent injury fund, they're told you pay 364 weeks of death benefits in whether or not any individual from your city has ever made a claim. Each particular city and political subdivision, and the reason
to
that
make
we...
make up the state.
Right. It's the individual
city... Well, I still just can't understand if 1,600 cities are paying money into the pool, whose function is to take that money and then pay claims out all over the state by the same rationale, and you don't complain about that, that's okay, right? By the same rationale, doesn't apply to the subsequent injury fund, where they're all paying amounts in there and it goes out the same way all over the state.
Because the difference is, and it's a valid question, but a very distinct difference. The difference is these are cities that each individually self-insure. They cover their own particular risk.
Well, I understand
they
it, but
they
their have
resources
well, I understand
individually.
It, but
the payments they make are based upon the proportionately the amount of claims that their citizens make, and that's not the case with the subsequent injury fund. The subsequent injury fund, they're told you pay 364 weeks of death benefits in whether or not any individual from your city has ever made a claim. Whereas with regard to TML Risk Pool, the payments made by the individual cities are based directly on that city's claims out of workers' comp claims that are paid as benefit payments by the risk pool. The risk pool acts sort of as an administrator for all of these self-insurance.
What percentage of the cities in Texas participate in this risk pool under self-insurance?
I am not sure it's a significant percentage that participate in this particular risk pool. There may be others that are participating in different ones. There are similar risk pools out there for counties
But with respect to cities, how many cities choose to self-insure as compared to the total number of cities in the state of Texas?
I don't know the number, but it's a high number. It's a high number self-insure because it is more economical, and they're invested in the public trust.
Is it safe to say that the vast majority of the state is covered with respect to, in terms of cities participating in a self-insurance plan?
I think that's right, and if I discover that's wrong, I'll send something to say that because I really don't know factually, but my impression is that that's correct, that it's the vast majority of the different public entities, and part of it is just how expensive private insurance has gotten. And also, the other problem is all of the various rulings out there that talk about the types of insurance that they can and cannot buy, so self-insuring is just prudent so you don't end up in litigation over.
Justice Enoch asked, could the state in the statute determining beneficiaries, could the state have designated itself as the default beneficiary?
I think not for two reasons, and I touched on the first one earlier, which is the provision that allows cities to provide comp insurance, which is Article 3, Section 61 of the Constitution, only authorizes the legislature to make law for the payment of benefits. And I don't think that you should read benefits outside of the context of how it's really used in insurance, which is a payment made to someone with an insurable interest, a family member, somebody that has some sort of financial relationship with the person, in some circumstances medical providers, things like that. But I think even more importantly, if you look at what Article 3, Section 52 has dealt with in the past, it's trying to make sure that the money benefits the individual city residents and their family members. You know, there have been pension plans that have been approved to be okayed, where the money is paid into a pension plan that goes back either to the employee or its family members, not, you know, being spread out throughout the state. And I think it really does sort of violate the substance of the two amendments.
You use the word benefit. It's not in 52A. Is it somewhere else?
Article 3, Section 61 is the specific authorization that, in the face of Article 3, Section 52, was needed to be passed so that cities could even participate in the workers' comp program.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council. That concludes the day's arguments, and the Marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, 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 the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.